I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Netflix's ridiculous fight between Mike Tyson and Jake Paul was not quite unqualified success. It's a qualified success, I guess, is what I'm saying. On the one hand, they claimed that 60 million users tuned in for the fight, which consisted of 8 2-minute rounds of a YouTube influencer beating up on a senior citizen. The co-headline fight featuring two women boxers reportedly logged 50 million viewers. You know, those are decent. Those are very good numbers. I'm not going to try and, you know, sugarcoat it. Those are very, very good numbers. But the influx of traffic did lead to something I haven't seen from Netflix in a long time. Not since, like, the earliest days of their streaming efforts. Their servers could not handle the crush of traffic. The stream degraded to substandard definition quality for long stretches when folks were able to log in at all. It's a little embarrassing for the service and a real problem. They have to be really worried about it, given that they have the Christmas Day NFL games coming up, which are going to feature a halftime performance by Beyonce. It's not clear to me that the NFL games will attract similar numbers last year, but I don't think they'll be that far off, right? Last year's AFC Championship game was viewed by a record 55 million viewers. Granted that these are regular season games, those are the playoff games. Christmas Day is different. People are busy with family, etc. But there's going to be a lot of people at home with nothing to do. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Plus, you know, there's the Beyonce factor. Who can say? Alyssa, you're not a boxing person. Peter, you're not a sports person. So you guys weren't watching the fight. But I do. I think it's pretty important to think about for a couple of reasons. The first, obviously, is that it highlights the importance of sports to the streaming networks going forward, right? Live events are only going to grow in importance for Netflix and the other services as they steal market share from the cable networks. It's already kind of a key factor in driving that growth. Netflix has already made a big bet on sports, kind of, in the sense of them picking up the WWE streaming rights from Peacock and taking away the broadcast rights from USA starting in 2025. The other interesting thing about the Tyson-Paul fight is that it did really feel like a throwback to an earlier era of social media, right? It was really a monoculture moment. Lots of tons and tons of people watching the same thing, but also complaining about the same thing. It's fun to complain about things in real time, to kind of commiserate about the poor quality of the stream, whining that it's not instantly available, laughing in unison when, and this is a thing that actually happened, the stream cleared up just enough to see a very clear shot of Mike Tyson's rear end. He was giving a locker room interview, and then freezing on the rear end. Just fantastic stuff all around. Peter, is the future of streaming idiot influencers trading half-hearted blows with elderly fighters? Is that what we have built this entire thing up to?
Well, I don't know if it's all of that, but I think the future of streaming is definitely idiot influencers. And this, to me, is is the takeaway from this is you were right. This is a monoculture moment, but it is a monoculture moment made in YouTube's image, made in maybe to a lesser extent TikTok's image, but especially YouTube and male YouTube preferences, which is they like big personalities doing stupid stuff where people get hurt. And who is the biggest person on YouTube? Who is the biggest influencer, the biggest account? It's Mr. Beast. And look, this is not even a criticism. I'm not a big watcher of Mr. Beast or a big fan one way or the other. It's just not my thing. But Mr. Beast's whole shtick is we're going to do something crazy and intense where maybe somebody will get hurt or something will get destroyed or blown up or, it's teenage boy energy all throughout. And I think that's what you saw, or that's what people who watched this, tried to watch this, saw with the Jake Paul fight. As Jake Paul came up from being a kind of obnoxious, attention-seeking stunt type. It's not exactly the same thing as Mr. Beast, but it was like, hey, look at me. Maybe I'm going to get hurt. Maybe this house is going to get, going to get burned down or something like that. And we're going to put it on film and put it on YouTube. And that's what is going to get attention. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that in Hollywood, in streaming, in sort of entertainment going forward, is that people are going to this is gonna leave, YouTubers who are doing this in a sort of semi-professional way, or even in a big way. This is gonna become just like the next thing is that entertainment is going to be about this, or a lot of entertainment is going to be influenced by influencer marketing culture, where everything is a kind of marketing stunt for your personal brand and for a particular personality who is known for being crazy. I mean, not like that's the thing, right? Like there will be maybe the niches will be a little bit more defined than that, but just kind of for being somebody who everybody knows. And this is, I mean, in some ways, it's not even the long tail. This is the full development of the Paris Hilton model of being famous just for being famous. Jake Paul hasn't ever done something specific other than be Jake Paul. And he is doing this because he's a YouTube guy, and this is what YouTube guys do, is they say, look at me, I'm going to do something dangerous. I'm going to do something crazy. And then everybody looks at them. And that's what happens.
So the fight on Friday night consisted of four fights, right? There were four bouts. The first was the two middle fights are the best, and those were all four fighters there were actual boxers. The very first fight, however, there was a guy who he's been in part of that Jake Paul universe, but the announcers, as he was coming to the ring, said something like, when a guy's got 150 million followers, you got to give him a shot, right? And I was like, no, that's actually not how boxing works at all. That's how people get hurt in boxing. Like that's not a good method for choosing who
it
should be.
It might not be how boxing works, but it is how entertainment is working and is going to work, like even more so in the future.
Yeah, Alyssa, this is really the kind of like Idiocracy effect, right?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that we've been talking a lot about the sort of Jake Paul of this equation, and not at all about the Mike Tyson of this equation, right? Because Tyson was someone who was this sort of incredibly important figure in like real boxing. He was, before he bit off Evander Holyfield's ear during the rematch, like he was a legitimately like exciting, explosive boxer with his, with a very, very troubled, actual life, right? I mean, he served time in prison for rape. He, was raised in unbelievably sort of difficult personal circumstances in a hardscrabble neighborhood. And so there's sort of a version of Mike Tyson that is kind of troublingly, thrillingly real. David Remnick wrote a profile of him in The New Yorker the year of the Holyfield rematch, Kid Dynamite Blows Up, that's sort of captures the maelstrom and drama and tragedy and strangeness of it all. And in subsequent years, Mike Tyson kind of remade himself as a character, right? Did movie cameos, played into his kind of high voice for comedic effect. Like there became a sort of, like there was the real Mike Tyson, and then there was this sort of very saleable avatar of Mike Tyson. And I think I find boxing, I have sort of personal reasons not to like boxing. It's just not something I would ever want to watch or enjoy. But part of what is interesting to me about this event is the sort of transparent ersatzness of it, right? Like, yes, Mike Tyson and Jake Paul both like walked into a ring wearing like weighted gloves, and in fact, like heavier gloves than they might have been required to wear in another jurisdiction, so they couldn't hurt each other as much. But like, they went into a ring and punched each other, right? Like that itself is a thing that happened. But what wasn't really the case was that this is like a real serious boxing match, to the extent, you know, in the terms that people understand boxing, right? I mean, like, Tyson's almost 60 years old. Jake Paul has sort of trained as a boxer and has a winning record, but has not really, I mean, and this was a licensed boxing match, you know, in Texas. It was not licensed. They could not get licensing in a number of other states. But his record has been assembled against people who are not really serious contenders. And so the whole thing just has this false, hollow, weird quality to it, that in addition to the sort of, you know, teenage boy culture, the YouTube of it all, is something I just find culturally very interesting, right? That, you know, you can have this huge event that everyone kind of understands is a joke, is not, you know, a fraud is the wrong word, but it's sort of a, you know, it's a simulacra of a real event performed, you know, behind these sort of heavy layers of irony.
There's a semi-seriousness. This is Bodie McBoatface, except in boxing form.
Yeah. And I find that, you know, totally separate from the ways in which I find boxing unappealing, I find that very sort of queasy and distasteful. That sort of that, the disappearance of the real in a sport that was sort of previously defined in part by its intense realness, right? Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, yes and no. The boxing has always been kind of interesting that way, right? Which is insofar as like, boxing has always had this element of you have guys who are challengers who are like legit title contenders. And as they work their way up through the ranks, they fight other guys who aren't taking dives precisely. But because of the insular and ridiculous nature of boxing promotion in and of itself, understood that they were not necessarily there to win the fights.
Right. They were there to sort of get beaten
right?
and up. That,
and that kind of that is very much what this fight is. Like, I don't think there was any agreement, right, for Mike Tyson to take a dive or for Mike Tyson to pull his punches.
You're not alleging certainly. Fraud.
I'm not alleging fraud. However, what I am alleging is that MVP Promotions, which I believe is owned in part by Jake Paul, paid Mike Tyson $20 million to be there. And if Mike Tyson had knocked him out in the first or second round of this fight, Mike Tyson would not be getting $20 million again from MVP anytime soon. And indeed, in the interview in the ring after the fight, you know, one of the guys asked, well, are you going to fight Logan Paul next? Who is Jake Paul's idiot brother. And Logan Paul's like, I'd kick his ass. Blah, blah. And Mike Tyson was like, sure, I'll do whatever. And like, that is the real thing here. Like, do they do something like this again? Does Netflix pay them a ton of money to do it? Do 60 million people tune in? And that is, I don't know. As you say, Alyssa, there's a fakeness to it all that is not, it's not quite kayfabe, to use the wrestling term, right? It's not quite totally fake, but it is fake enough to make the whole thing kind of ridiculous. Now, the flip side of this is that the two middle fights in this in this card were actually really good because it featured four real boxers who were all trying to win, who were all very obviously trying to...
Wait, is that what people want from sports?
That's what people want from sports, is my understanding.
You wouldn't know it from the way this thing has been marketed.
And those were actual real good fights, and, you know, I... but again, that's not why people tune in. People didn't tune in because they wanted to watch, you know, the Ramos, I forget with who the second fight was. They didn't tune in for the women's card. They wanted to watch, Mike Tyson and Jake Paul. And that is, as you say, Peter, this is kind of the state of the entertainment industry.
Everything ends up being marketing for something that isn't anything. It's just a personality. It's just a kind of wild brand. It's just a channel that you're supposed to watch for the advertisement for the next thing. Frankly, a lot of the Marvel Cinematic Universe kind of ended up like this, especially deep into phase 3, 4, or whatever. Like, you weren't watching for the thing. You were watching so you could talk about it with other people. And also then the thing itself was just the advertisement for the next thing, or the... sort of like the stunt layer, the payment layer. I can't even there's nothing underneath, right? Like it's like Alyssa is exactly right to use the word ersatz here. It's a little weird, the entertainment landscape that we are entering into, where it used to be even that, like, if you were a personality, a lot of what you did was showcase people who were doing something real. And that, sure, that still happens to some degree. A lot of the big podcasters, they're personalities unto themselves, but they are talking to people who are doing real intellectual work or making movies, or they're actors, or, right, they have an art, a craft, maybe they're businessmen, whatever it is they're doing. They're running something that is running or doing something that is real. But a lot of the YouTube personality business seems to be built around just sort of stringing people along to the next thing without anything that is substantive or intended to last underneath.
Yeah, and I just hate it. I hate it.
All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that the Paul Tyson fight is the future of entertainment? Alyssa?
The culture is bad and we should all go be desert hermits.
I'll take that as a controversy. Peter?
I'm going to have to call this a non-troversy, and the reason why is that if you call this a controversy, you're playing into what the Jake Paul, Mike Tyson fight worldview wants you to see this as. Like, they want you to be like, whoa, can you believe it? Whoa, man, I can't believe that, right? Like, that's the reaction they want, and don't give it to them. Just be like, who cares?
But you're saying, by doing this, you're doing the same thing. You're saying that it is a controversy, but you don't want to say it's a controversy, so you say it's a non-troversy. You're doing layers upon layers here. This is, you just got to call the thing what it is.
This is a crypto reaction. If you can figure out, this is a Straussian controversy or non-troversy response. If you can figure out what I actually think, good for you, because I don't even know.
Controversy. We should invade Netflix and bomb it and subjugate its peoples.
That's not how you fix things. That's also your solution to everything, Sonny. Come on. Come up with a new solution.
Speaking of things we need to bomb, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on the enduring peel of The Wizard of Oz. We gotta take it to the wizard. He can't be allowed to get away with this any longer. Now, on to the main event. A real pain. A reminder, as always, because there was some discussion in the comments last week, we'll be discussing plot points throughout the film, so if you're worried about spoilers and stuff, you should split. Though this is one of those movies where not very much happens. I mean that as a compliment. I'm not saying it's boring. I'm just saying it's a movie where, like, its plot is not really the issue here. It's a movie about relationships, et cetera, et cetera. But again, if you're worried about spoilers, you haven't seen it yet, you're thinking about seeing it, You should not listen to this, okay? All right, anyway, on to A Real Pain. Written and directed by Jesse Eisenberg, who also stars, A Real Pain features Eisenberg and Kieran Culkin as David and Benji Kaplan, respectively. They are cousins who have gotten together for a trip to Poland to see the ancestral home of their grandmother, who has recently passed away, and bequeathed them some money to take this trip. The Kaplans are on a first-class tour of Poland. They're led by their British host, James, who's played by Will Sharp, with an interesting assortment of fellow characters. There's a married couple. There's a recent divorcee, Marcia, who's played by Jennifer Grey. Traoré and a Rwandan Jewish convert named Eloge, I think. I can't remember how to pronounce it. Played by Kurt. Again, I'm going to butcher this. Kurt Egaiwin. Anyway, the plotting is minimal, and you quickly realize why this film was subsidized in part by the Polish film industry, because it is very much a tour of that nation that puts, you know, kind of the modern iteration of Poland in a pretty nice light. There's no shying away from past atrocities, but, you know, as it is now, the trains kind of run on time, the hotels are pretty sparkling, there's stuff to be learned, there's sights to be seen. Warsaw seemed very nice. But this is a movie, look, this is a movie about people and what people are looking for out of life and each other. And there's one very specific way in which this movie feels like almost desperately real, and that's the relationship between Benji and David. And I don't mean in terms of like their family or how they reconnect or how they drifted apart or any of that, though these are all elements of their relationship that are explored in the movie. More specifically, what I'm referring to is how extroverts and introverts interact with each other, right? I describe this in my review as the introvert's dilemma. And that dilemma goes a little bit like this, right? An introvert is an introvert, at least in part, because they don't want to be a bother to anybody else. They think acting outrageously makes the target of their intention uncomfortable, and they seek to avoid adding discomfort to anyone's life by any means necessary. The extrovert, on the other hand, is seemingly oblivious to all of this. They just go about their life, nary a worry or a care. And when an introvert is friends with an extrovert, the extrovert causes the introvert discomfort by proxy, right? And in this movie, you can almost see Eisenberg David apologizing to the rest of the tour with his eyes when Benji does something crazy. He's like mouthing, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry." You know, just ignore him. But here's the rub. The extrovert is almost always better liked in these situations and encounters. He is more memorable. What the introvert mistakes as awkward, the extrovert understands to be kind of friendliness and outgoingness. They make connections, leading to more extroversion, leading to more connections. The introvert remains alone and lonely and quietly resenting all of this. Eisenberg writes, directs, and acts out this dynamic with almost eerie precision. As a mildly introverted person myself, look, I can make friends. I just prefer not to. I hang out with a lot of extroverts, right? That's just my lot in life. It's like he was kind of staring directly into my soul. I felt seen, as the kids say. When James, at the end of this tour, says that Benji is the first person who has really made him think about what his duty is as a tour guide, it's a re-examination that comes about because Benji is insanely rude to him on several occasions during this tour. And then he follows up this, like, heartfelt, you know, thank you in speech to Benji by just saying, you know, "Oh, bye, David." It was like a laugh out loud funny moment for me. I guffawed in the theater. I think I was the only person who did. I probably got some weird looks. But, you know, that is what it is. That's what it's like to be an introverted person around an extrovert all the time. You feel like they're doing everything wrong and you realize, oh, no, actually, this is what people really like. Anyway, Alyssa, I connected and kind of talked about this film on this level because I don't feel comfortable or, you know, I don't have the same sort of personal experience to discuss it on a religious or a cultural level. But obviously, the Holocaust, the lives of Jewish people in Poland and elsewhere are a key component of this film and its larger meaning. I don't know. I'm curious if you had any personal connection or feelings about this. Do you think Eisenberg did a good job of capturing that sensibility, that kind of cultural sensibility?
Well, first I want to say I think you've committed extrovert slander here.
This is what you people are like.
Yes, I definitely think you've committed extrovert slander. Benji isn't so much an extrovert as he is just like a narcissist. I feel like I am in many ways sort of the target audience for this movie, right? You know, I was raised by, you know, a Jewish father, lapsed Catholic mother. You know, I'm personally very secular. My family does, you know, a couple of Jewish holidays a year. You know, I think of myself sort of ethnically as Jewish, even though given my parentage and my lack of Jewish education, I would not be considered sort of religiously Jewish. I would not, it's all of this is complicated, but I sort of understand myself as Jewish ethnically. And I do think this movie captures to a certain extent the sort of a sort of like secular kind of secular Jewish experience. But I found it, I found that whole aspect of the movie very, very flimsy, right? I mean, even the person who, you know, even the character who's survived the Rwandan genocide and, you know, is a convert kind of describes himself as not observant, except in that he sort of keeps the Sabbath, right? There's nobody on this tour who is religiously Jewish at all. And, you know, the relationship between Dave and Benji, I mean, if what we see of their relationship doesn't tell us very much about their relationship and their family or about sort of Judaism and the experience of this kind of spiritual pilgrimage, right? I mean, we finally come to understand what kind of the incident is that made Dave pull back from Benji. But we don't, for example, get any sense of like who their grandma Dory was or why she was particularly important to either of them. I mean, Benji certainly felt like she cared about him a lot and that was important to him. But we get no sense of Dave's relationship to her. We get no sense of her relationship to Poland, right? I mean, there, you know, we know that she, you know, lived through the Holocaust and survived. But she does not emerge as sort of a person or a catalyst at all. And, you know, maybe the movie is intended to be a commentary on the shallowness of a certain kind of Jewish engagement with this part of history. But I don't, it's not sort of biting or substantial enough to even be that, right? I mean, there are so few actual conversations between the characters as a whole. I found the whole thing very, very flimsy in a way that I found very frustrating. And I think, I mean, the one part of the movie that really works on any sort of deeper level is, you know, the visit to one of the concentration camps in Poland and the sort of the cinematography of the sort of the blue stains left behind by Zyklon B, the chemical gas that was used to kill Jews en masse in some of the gas chambers. Like that, there's a sort of eerie and uncomfortable beauty in that. And the movie, you know, Eisenberg seems comfortable as a director just sort of, you know, watching the characters as they walk through that death chamber. But again, you know, that sequence happens so fast. Like, it's interesting how quickly the characters move through that space. That again, it sort of mirrors the film's kind of inattention and almost sort of disinterest in what it's taken on. I found it really frustrating.
That's interesting, and I understand what you're saying. I do. It is a movie that is almost a-religious. Like it feels very uninterested in what the actual religious practices are here, right? Yeah. I mean, like...
And there's no sort of re-engagement with that, like, right? Like, James is himself not religious. He's sort of, I mean, he's a historian. But there's no, you know, they go to this kosher restaurant and Benji kind of makes a scene because there's a pianist playing Hava Nagila, which, like, is really hard for me to believe that, like, a good kosher restaurant would have someone doing that. Like, it's a weird false note. And yeah, there's no sense that anyone in the movie really experiences anything, right? Like, we're told that the characters are like going to this place because it's really good, like Polish kosher food or whatever. But like, what do they eat? How do they feel about it? Right? I mean, there's no, you know, Richard Brody often has this complaint. One of the New Yorker's film critics often has this complaint that movies. He specifically doesn't like movies where characters don't talk about anything except what's necessary to advance the plot. And I think that's, in this case, I feel like A Real Pain kind of fits that description, right? And that, you know, it's I mean, it's a very taut movie. It's like 90 minutes. And there's nothing sort of shaggy or experiential about it, right? Like, nobody talks about the food. Nobody talks about sort of the landscape. You know, no one has like a religious experience. As far, you know, they talk about there being an old synagogue, but they don't appear to actually go to it. And there's just this absence of interaction between the characters and the landscape to which they're making a pilgrimage. And as a result, there's sort of a lack of connection to each other. I just found it really odd. It's just really flimsy.
Yeah. Peter, what did you make of A Real Pain?
I had mixed feelings. There were a bunch of things I really liked and then some things that I didn't think quite added up. So I think I'll take Alyssa's point that it didn't seem like these folks ever quite connected with each other, but I actually thought that was a little bit of the point. There is a particular kind of male friendship that goes back to childhood, especially if there's a kind of, bond by blood, right? You're sort of thrown into, well, we're in the same family together, where you end up being quite close to each other, but there's not actually a reason why. It's just you spent a lot of time together when you were 12 and you got into some stuff, right? I don't know, if you're 12 right now, it's you watched a lot of Mr. Beast together. And like, that's what you did, even though you're totally different people. And when you're adults, you realize you're totally different people, but you still have that kind of thing in the background. And you have a shared person maybe that you liked, or some sort of, I don't know, we went to the beach together, whatever it is. Like, there's something that you sort of latch onto to share, even though you are just not the same. And it's not even obvious why you should still be friends. It's just that, like, you're friends because you've always been friends. What are you going to do? And so that made some sense to me, especially given that, spoilers, we're going to do a spoiler here, just so for people who don't want spoilers, you should maybe not listen to the rest. But just given the fact that we learn that Benji tried to commit suicide months before this trip, and that, you know, sort of in addition to that kind of historical connection of just like we spent our childhood together, that can drive a kind of desire to reconnect and a sort of even figure out, like, what is it that we have in common? Why are we friends? Or just the sense of wanting to take care of somebody who is clearly troubled. And I thought that stuff mostly worked. I thought the movie was technically pretty nice. It's not super showy or flashy, but it's really tightly paced, not just at 90 minutes, but in terms of hitting the beats and sort of moving through the paces of the story, you know, the kind of giving us this arc, even though it's a little bit slight. I thought that was really well done. This opening and closing shots that are these kind of perfect mirrors of each other, just kind of nicely chosen stuff. And even some of the kind of really domestic kind of theoretical, the kinds of interior shots that could be really boring. They weren't flashy. They weren't like, wow, Jesse Eisenberg is a style master, but they were nicely done. They looked better than they had to. And so I feel like on a craft level, this was actually pretty well made in a bunch of ways.
I agree with that.
And the two central performances are just excellent. I think the movie's biggest problem is actually that I unlike Sonny, didn't buy the way that people reacted to Kieran Culkin's character. His obnoxiousness was so much and so flagrant that I had a hard time accepting that people would just be like, well, oh, he's funny. Oh, he's a little troubled, but like coming at, you know, Sonny, you talked about this. People come out of every one of these situations thinking, well, like in some ways, somehow thinking better of him or thinking nice enough. But he's got like a point, you know, maybe I do include too many facts and figures. Maybe it is ridiculous that we're up here in first class, or I don't know. It's not ridiculous that we're up here in first class. He throws a fit at one point because they're all in first class on this kind of Holocaust tour thing. And he feels like this is disrespectful to their Jewish ancestors. And people are like, well, they don't certainly start feeling guilty about it themselves, but they're like, maybe they sort of like, he's just having an emotional reaction. And I feel like I have known in groups in my life, people like him in some way who are a lot, who are at times obnoxious, who just don't have a filter. And when that happens, people do give them some sort of berth, some sort of like space. Like they don't confront them in most cases, but they try to find, if there's like a tight group where you're sort of, you feel like you're stuck with this person, people try to avoid that person. People try to find a way to get that person out of the group. Like it doesn't, it, they don't come away thinking this person is actually has really great point.
Changed my life.
Like that's, they think that someone like that is a, maybe the, maybe they have some sort of sympathy. Maybe they're like, well, it's sad because this person is clearly troubled. But either way, nobody wants to be around that. It's not nobody, but people in general try to remove themselves from situations with a person like that. And you didn't see that here. You, in fact, saw this weird, like the movie schematically and for the for plot purposes, has everyone else react to him in a way that I just didn't really buy.
Well, let me, can I just offer a suggestion here, which is that the movie is like fairly explicitly from David's point of view, right? It is from the Eisenberg character's point of view. And I do wonder how much of this is him suggesting this is how he sees people react in situations like this, how he like kind of has a read on it, you know?
But at the same time, you do have this couple, Mark and Diane, who are like absolutely the most thinly characterized characters in the movie, who clearly do find him sort of irritating and embarrassing. And the movie would have had some more dramatic tension if you had seen more of Mark's responses. Like, no, actually, I don't feel guilty for like surviving and being back in Poland in a first class train, right? Like, this is, you know, almost a sense of like Jewish triumphalism. It's like, we survived, right? Like, and, you know, it's interesting. I mean, my great-grandparents came to America, you know, before, I think in the teens. So they were, you know, well-established. There's not anyone in my sort of direct line of my family who died in the Holocaust. But there was this really strong, you know, they did have relatives who died. And, you know, I think in my father's family growing up, there's this sense that, like, we don't buy German. We don't buy German cars. Like, we, you know, there was not sort of a desire to go there. But there was also, you know, I think this sense that sort of the country needed to be punished. And, you know, obviously this is about sort of Germany, not Poland, which is, you know, and I think remembering that, like, the European Jewish diaspora includes people from Poland, from Ukraine, from places that were hugely affected by sort of the Soviet invasion in the latter half of the war. You know, I think that sort of emotional geography is very complicated, and the movie is so flat about it, and it denies itself sort of interpersonal dramatic tension by refusing to engage with that larger sense of historical memory and complexity.
Yeah. Okay. one last, there is some, I know Kieran Culkin is getting some awards buzz, but Peter, you say you don't entirely buy his performance, or just don't buy the reaction to
his performance. I think his performance is great. Mm-hmm. And the movie is a showcase for his talents. I think that's also true for Eisenberg. What I didn't buy was the reaction of everyone else in the group and the way that everyone else sort of didn't really make an effort to just be like, I don't want to be around this person. I'm going to find some way to, I buy that people are not going to be directly confrontational most of the time. I don't buy that people are going to sort of accept this and feel, oh, he's finding himself and he's maybe even helping us all understand ourselves a little bit better.
Fair enough. Fair. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on A Real Pain? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
Thumbs up. I think this movie shows promise from Eisenberg, but it has some issues, but it works pretty well for the things that it does.
I may go thumbs up just because I do think, again, I do think that that relationship between Eisenberg and Culkin's characters gets to a very real point. And again, maybe this is just me reading my own life into, you see yourself in the movie and you want to say, oh, yeah, that's a true thing. It's people, you know, Alyssa, just you say he's a narcissist and not an extrovert. And I ask, is there a big difference?
Yes. The difference between introverts and extroverts is extroverts get energy from engaging with other people. And with introverts, it costs them energy, right? Like, that is like the textbook. Understand? I mean, I'm sorry that interacting with me is so exhausting for you, but I find our weekly conversations a source of rejuvenation and joy.
Okay. See, everything I do makes it hard for me. It's burning my own personal essence. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation is the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.